Thank you very much, Mr. Jennings, and a happy Friday evening to everyone out there listening to WGN Radio, either on 720 AM or, of course, online at WGNRadio.com, wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining. John Hanson until 1 o'clock in the morning, tomorrow morning, of course. This is October 11th. It is 10:06 p.m., and we are 18 stories above the Chicago River and Wacker Drive. We've got a packed show for you today. A little bit later on, we're going to be chatting. We're going to do What's Up with Space with Mike Wall from space.com. Blake Stubbs going to be joining us as well to chat about some cool things happening at the movies. And we're going to have some really cool local stuff as well. But let's talk to Mr. Mike Heideman. Mike Heideman, how you doing, buddy?
John, it's great to see you. I'm doing fantastic.
Well rested because you filled in for DiGilio this morning.
Yes, I did. And I fell asleep right after and haven't woken up since.
You're still you slept walk on over here.
Yep. But it was a great show. Thanks again to Nick and Mary and everybody and Pete and Tom for a great show last night. It was an honor to fill in for Nick.
Big apologies to everyone on Michigan Avenue that saw Mike sleepwalking down to the studio. He doesn't know what he does when he's in those moments. He just kind of guides his way over here somehow.
It wasn't a zombie. It was Michael Heideman. Yes.
Yeah.
Just making sure she knew.
312-91-7200. We'd love for you to join the conversation and get involved. You can text, you can call on in, and your participation. I'm going to say it's voluntary tonight, or not, it's involuntary tonight. Well, it's always voluntary normally, but we need your help a little bit later on because we're going to be doing something fun. We'll play a little Today I Learned, of course, as well, and some other things. But Mike, can we get some dramatic music to tee up what we're going to be doing here after the first commercial break? There we go. And this is really going to set it up. It is spooky season, after all. And, of course, here in Chicago, we are, I don't want to say blessed, we have one of the spookiest, scariest stories built into our city's history. It's a mystery that has reigned now for 148 years, and here is how it starts. Late one night, when we were all in bed, Mrs. O'Leary lit a lantern in the shed. Her cow kicked it over, then winked her eye and said, "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight." The Chicago Fire, residents waking up in Chicago 148 years ago today, with tons of buildings, people dead after 2 days of fire rained through the city. We're going to walk through the history. Look, I think everyone knows a little bit about the Chicago Fire. I think we all have our theories of the things that we know. Michael, I mean, we all know the basics. 1871, fire spread.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of buildings burned.
The folklore, the cow kicked over the can.
Yes.
You know, and it spread, and then we needed to rebuild the city, the whole thing.
Not a can of lantern, Mike.
Oh.
Just kicked over a can of beans. That didn't start no fire, Mike.
I heard it was a can.
No, it was a lantern. Right. No, that wouldn't have started any fire. Yeah, there is so many different theories out there, and I have narrowed it down to four culprits. So what we're going to be doing just after the break is I'm going to tell you the true story of the Chicago Fire, then all the permutations of the conjecture. I mean, it was 1871, so a lot of people have a lot of different theories. And then I need you, listeners, to be the jury. 312-981-7200. Get ready to call in towards the end of the story and vote for who we finally agree upon, maybe, who is the culprit behind the start of the Chicago Fire. I've got it narrowed down to four candidates. Of course, Mrs. O'Leary's cow is one of them. There's someone named Peg Leg Sullivan. Who was a likely culprit. In fact, one of our esteemed aldermen said, in quotes, Edward Burke, about 21 years ago, tried to actually get the city to kind of indict him postmortemly, of course, as being okay. The one, as being Peg-Leg Sullivan. There's a theory of comets and meteors being what caused the Chicago Fire. There's some really interesting facts about other fires that were lit on the very same night. In fact, far more deadly fires in Wisconsin on the very same night, and in Michigan, too. And then there's the story of Lewis Cohn, who is a gambler, and he is the only person to have ever at least partially admitted to being in the barn when the fire started, and I had never heard of this gentleman. So we're going to be breaking it down and determining who really set who or what really set the Chicago fire and chat about those stories as well. John Hanson until 1 a.m. Quick commercial break, and then we're going to talk about the Chicago fire here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Hanson in until 1 in the morning. Thanks so much for joining us, and we say a pleasant good evening. He's bopping over in the news studio, which has been newly disinfected. I saw him spreading the wipes all over. Mr. Roger Badish, I hope you're feeling better, my friend.
Well, I'm here with you. It's a Friday night in Chicago, and I'm feeling fine.
You ready to be the judge and jury here tonight, Mr. Badish?
Guilty!
No.
Oh, wait, what?
Okay, Roger's all fired up, ready to go. No pun intended.
Right.
Michael, are you ready to go?
Always ready to go.
In case you just are joining us, we are going to break down the Chicago fire, which had just been put out 148 years ago today, and people were waking up in Chicago. Many lost loved ones. Much of the city burned, wondering where they'd go next and wondering how it started. So, why don't we start from the beginning? I just want to let everyone know I got some great information from the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, a book by Paul Benny. Wikipedia, big helper too. The History Channel, Time Magazine, Chicago Magazine, and Chicago Tribune as well. So, 1871, Chicago, the fastest growing city in America. But haphazardly, wooden construction had imperiled it to be an invisible enemy. In fact, a single spark from a tossed down cigar or an unattended candle could ignite fire that would rage unchecked. Chicagoans weren't blind to the threat. Only 1 month before the Chicago fire, the Tribune, which of course is the big newspaper here, had warned Chicagoans that buildings downtown were mere fire traps, pleasing to the eye, and nothing more than shams and shingles. So a month beforehand, Chicago Tribune was already hypothesizing that something bad could happen. So let's go to October 1871, a dry month in the city. The last decent rains had fallen over 3 months prior. Can you imagine? We've had so much rain over the last couple weeks. It seems like every Friday night we're talking about storms in the area. 3 months since the last fires had fallen. So you've got a real dry tinderbox forming. Not only in Chicago, but of course the entire Great Lakes region had been very dry. The wells were dry. The grass was brown, and the tar roofs simmered and bubbled in the sun. Each day, dry winds from the overheated prairies blew into the city and parched all the buildings. It was a dangerous condition for a town built completely, mostly by white pine. From the wooden fences that marked the boundary of every single property to the sheds filled with hay, pine shavings, everything in Chicago had grown brittle as kindling under the sweltering sun. So anything could start a fire, right? Boys playing with matches set houses on fire. It happened all the time. A spark flying from the torch of a roof repairman, that would set a church building on fire. All these things happened in the weeks leading up to the fire. The fire department was incredibly busy. And then on October 7th, so 1 day before the start of one of the most infamous fires in American history, there was a blaze at the Lull and Holmes planing mill that has sapped the final strength of the firefighters. So they've been working throughout the months, and we get this big fire at the Lull and Holmes planing mill. It was a woodworking factory on the west side of Chicago, nestled in among frame houses, a paper box company, coal yards. 7 million feet of wood were stacked in lumber yards in the surrounding neighborhood. It was around 11 o'clock at night, and the mill caught fire. No one ever sure why. Flames quickly jumping to other buildings. It was a strong wind. The fire, it spread it north, changed directions, drove it southwest. The piles of lumber caught fire and helped scattered flames like quicksilver. And in 20 minutes, 4 city blocks were ablaze. This isn't the big fire. This is the day before the big fire. 3 alarms sounded. And look, fires in Chicago at the time, honestly, they were cheap entertainment. This according to the book, The Great Chicago Fire of 1871. When the skies lit up with the rose glows of flames, people poured from their houses like a bell had rung at a free boxing match. So the Lowell and Holmes fire was the biggest one yet. Thousands took to the street to watch it. In fact, they blocked Adam Street. They prevented the blaze from spreading north. They didn't have the manpower to protect the river with its wooden bridges, wooden ships, and wooden train cars lined up. Spectators sprung into action. They saved a railroad freight and passenger buildings. They tore down sheds that lay between the fire and the bigger buildings so that the flames would run out of fuel. These amateur firefighters managed to roll the train cars safely out of the way. The fire department putting up a heroic fight. They had drawn a line at Adam Street. They would said that that fire is not crossing over this. They hooked up 12 hoses, completely flooded the burning area. So they were able to contain this fire. But the citizens were there, of course, watching. In fact, the fire marshal and chief were yelling at police to arrest people because they were blocking, they were gawking, and they were preventing it. So that morning, even before the fire was completely out, the Tribune ran its Sunday paper with special coverage of the event, which they dubbed the Great Chicago Fire. The first paragraph was eerily prophetic from the Chicago Tribune the morning of what ended up being the big fire. For days past, alarm has followed alarm, but the comparatively trifling losses have familiarized us to the pealing of the courthouse bell, and we had forgotten that the absence of rain for 3 weeks had left everything in such a dry and inflammable condition that a spark might set a fire which would sweep from end to end of the city. That's the morning of the fire, the Tribune post that. So people are very aware of what's happened. I mean, Roger, this walking through this history is just fascinating. The first-hand accounts of what really set up this situation.
Nobody knows. I mean, really, this is not taught in any of the schools.
Oh, no. They
just the Chicago fire. The city almost burned down. Blah, blah, blah. Mrs. O'Leary Carl.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
We don't know the history before it, let alone the night before.
Right.
This is very interesting, and it may change my judgment.
Oh, that's right. Because at the end of this, we're going to try and figure out what actually happened. I'm just trying to give you all the context.
Yeah.
I'm setting it up like opening statements.
I'm the
prosecutor marching around the courthouse ready to, or the defense attorney.
Pound your fist on the bar?
Bailiff. Let's get a bailiff in here. Heidemann's the bailiff tonight.
Okay.
He's that sassy bailiff that participates.
Sassy?
Yeah, well, he's always a little sassy. All right. Mike, you're our sassy bailiff. How are you feeling so far, Mike?
I feel great. You know, that's why I wore my tuxedo to court. sassy too.
You know, I once wrote a blackout scene for something like that.
Right.
Yeah, a guy walking across the stage holding a suit on a hanger. And he's taking, another guy walks by and says, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm taking my suit to court." Half an hour later, a guy walks with a ladder and the suit on a hanger. And a guy walks by and says, "Where are you going now?" He says, "I'm taking my suit to a higher court."
Oh, boy. By the way, 708 has already texted. I don't think we have to do the rest of the story. They say he solved it. It's Bartman. He started the Chicago fire. All right. So we've set up the scene now.
Yeah.
So there's a fire the night before that the Tribune calls the Great Chicago Fire, not knowing what's in store on October 8th, 1871. So the Sunday afternoon following the Lull and Holmes fire that we were talking about, the fire chief, Williams, he went home, he tried to sleep, but in his usual dedicated way, he woke up several times and attended to the business of the fire department. On October 8th, he had to put out a small fire on the south side of the city. He climbed on the wagon and he headed home again. The winds began to rise. He tugged his helmet down to keep it from blowing away. Then, as reports have it, he turned to his driver and said, "We are going to have a burn. I can feel it in my bones." "I'm going to bed early," he said. "I feel as though I've got to get out and be out between this morning and this wind is blowing." And boy, was it. And now we go to the cow barn. Around 9 p.m. on October 8th, 1871, the fire chief fast asleep in Chicago. Daniel Pegleg Sullivan, who is suspect number one. Pegleg Sullivan sat down on a wooden sidewalk, pausing a few moments to enjoy the strangely hot October night and its humming wind. He was a 26-year-old drayman, which I don't know what that is, or a cart driver. Oh, good. Just read the next few words, John. That'll help.
That'll help, yeah.
Who had lost his leg in a railroad accident. As he sat down on the wooden boards, he adjusted his peg leg to make himself comfortable, leaned back against a fence that ran behind the sidewalk. Before him, the West Side neighborhood of poor Irish immigrants was going to sleep, the lamps blinking out one by one. He yawned. He, too, would have to go to bed in a few minutes so he could get up early, hitch up his horses, and drive his cart for the oil company. So this is on DeKoven Street, which is a name that is not familiar to us. If you know the story, it is. It's basically an alley. And when they said this was on the southwest side of the city, that was in 1871. Now where right. we know it is not that far away. Think of White Palace Grill at Canal and Roosevelt and go a block north and a block west. You're right there. We could probably see it if there were no buildings between
here
and there.
Well, you know what's there now, if I'm not mistaken.
The Chicago Fire Academy.
You got that right.
Is on the site.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, across the street from Daniel, Pegleg Sullivan, were two houses, one facing the street and another tucked behind it. The one facing the street was the McLaughlin's house, and fiddle music was floating from the windows. Hey, Mike, nice job. You got this fiddle music queued up pretty good.
Oh, I know the story like the back of my hand.
So the McLaughlin's, they were having a little party, a Sunday night celebration to celebrate the arrival of a relative from Ireland. The house behind that house was the O'Leary house, where Catherine and Patrick O'Leary lived with their five children. All the lights were already out in the O'Leary house, and just behind that was the O'Leary's barn, where Catherine O'Leary kept her five milk cows and her horse and calf. And that's suspect number two. So Daniel knew that barn very well, Pegleg. His mother kept a cow in there, and some nights Daniel would actually just stop in and feed it hay. Now, as Daniel slumped against the fence, feeling increasingly sleepy, he thought he saw something strange. It looked like a yellow tongue of light kind of waving from side to side at the O'Leary barn. And as he watched it, his body began to grow stiff with worry. He straightened up off the fence, straining for a better look. It's 9 at night. It's dark. The yellow light flickered and wagged in the darkness. And then he knew it. It was a flame, no doubt about it. His heart started to pound as he scrambled from the wooden sidewalk into the street. He struggled to make it. His wooden leg couldn't help him move any faster. Fire! 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 He shouted into the wind. He got across the darkened lawn to the O'Leary property, making his way straight for the barn. As he stepped inside, he felt this blast of heat. He saw a tempest of flames whipping back and forth in the hayloft. It's hay. It's dry. The barn, everything is dry, and everything's going up pretty fast. It was too late to save that barn, but Daniel thought he might be able to save some of the animals. Four cows to his left, he managed to untie two of them before the heat became too intense. He yelled at the cows, but they stood frozen, refusing to flee. The flames were too strong now. The die had been cast, and the Great Chicago Fire had started. We've met two of our suspects. We'll hear more about the fire and meet our other two suspects in a bit. On WGN. 720 WGN. John Hansen here till 1 in the morning. And we're trying to decide who really started the Chicago fire. And we need your help through and to 91-7200. All right. So we're telling the story first with big help. And thank you to the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, the book written by Paul Benny. All right, so we're going to set our scene again for those of you just joining us. Paul Pegleg Sullivan is the name of a gentleman who was nearby after celebrating a party, or he knew there was a party nearby. He was laying against his fence. He spotted a fire in the O'Leary's barn just a few houses away. He ran into the barn. He knew it well, and he was helping some of the cows get out of the fire, and that's where we left off, because Daniel's story, Pegleg Sullivan, is a fascinating one at that. So Daniel's in the fire. It's hot in this barn, and he's trying to save these terrified animals. Four cows to his left. He unties two of them, and that heat becomes intense. So he yells at the cows. We talked about this. But Daniel felt like he was going to die with these petrified animals. He ran for the alleyway door, but his peg leg, he had it injured in an accident earlier, his peg leg slipped and sent him sprawling. He coughed in the thick black smoke and tried to stand. Before he could get his balance, a calf came running from behind and banged his hip. The animal's back was on fire, and it was howling in pain and fear. Daniel grabbed the rope around its neck and pulled it with him. Remember, there's flames everywhere at this point. So Daniel grabbed the rope, pulled it with him towards the barn door. Together, they burst into the alley, where Daniel slapped the flames off the calf's back. So this commotion now is raising, the fire is growing, and at last the neighbors begin to emerge from their houses, and one of them, a man named Dennis Regan, ran out of the O'Leary's house and woke the family. Mr. O'Leary came out of the yard, scratched his head in disbelief. Kate, he yelled, the barn is afire. Mrs. O'Leary and her five children ran from the house. The neighbors helped Mr. O'Leary throw buckets of water onto his house, which had already begun to smolder. Mrs. O'Leary, faced with the loss of her barn, her livestock, tried at least to save a new wagon that was parked behind the barn, but the searing heat would not let her near enough. Soon the sparks flew, started the wagon, a shed, another barn on fire. Then the flames sped across a wooden fence to the Dalton's house, the first actual house to catch fire, and the Great Chicago Fire had begun. We've met two of our suspects of who started this, actually. Daniel Pegleg Sullivan, more on him in a bit. And, of course, one of the cows, the old adage that the lantern was kicked over. That sort of conspiracy, I guess, spread through folklore, through tellings and local news. But let's talk about the spread of the fire. So firefighters finally arrive at DeCoven Street again. They're exhausted. They've been fighting fires, including a giant one the night before. The fire chief was trying to get some much-needed sleep. It's dry, and this fire spreads quickly to neighboring buildings. It was progressing towards the Central Business District. Keep in mind, it's about a mile southwest of downtown, Roosevelt Canal-ish, if you can kind of picture that, kind of where the West Loop is, White Palace Grill, and the site of the current Chicago Fire Academy. So this fire is spreading to the business district. Firefighters had hoped that the south branch of the river and an area that had previously been burned would actually act as a natural fire break. But along the river were lumber yards, warehouses, coal yards, barges, and the bridges across the river were not steel as we know them now. They were wooden, of course. So the fire grew, and that southwest wind intensified, became superheated. It caused structures to catch fire from the heat and from the burning debris, of course, from the wind. So the fire started around 9. By midnight, flaming debris blew across the river and landed on the roofs of the Southside Gas Works. With the fire moving across the river, moving rapidly towards the heart of the city, this is when panic sets in. The mayor at the time was a man named Roswell B. Mason. He sent messages to nearby towns asking for help. Imagine if you telegraphed, that would be my guess, Roger. I think it's probably the only way to communicate quickly in 1871.
Yeah, they didn't have shortwave radio or anything like that. No, no.
Right, or maybe messenger by horses. I don't know. Whatever you can do.
Or grab a kid on the corner and tell him to go run over.
Yeah.
You know.
When the courthouse caught fire, he ordered the building to be evacuated and the prisoners jailed in the basement to be released. 2.5 hours later, 2:30 in the morning, now we're on October 9th. The courthouse collapsed, sending the great bell crashing down. Some witnesses reported hearing the sound from a mile away. As more buildings succumbed to the flames, a major contributing factor to the fire spread was a meteorological phenomenon known as a fire whirl. As overheated air rises, it comes in contact with the cooler air, begins to spin. It's kind of like a fire tornado, for lack of a better description.
Oh, I hate those. Yeah. Really bad.
They happen in California a lot.
Oh, my.
Well, these fire whirls are what likely drove flaming debris so high and so far. So areas far away from the source of the fire where it had spread are catching fire. Because remember, it's so dry that you get some flying debris that's on fire. It lands on a nearby building or a couple blocks down.
Within split seconds.
Yep. Such debris was blown across the main branch of the Chicago River. So now we're crossing the south branch. Obviously, it splits. Now we're crossing it again to the north side.
Okay.
It blows across the main branch to a railroad car carrying kerosene. The fire had jumped the river a second time. It was raging across the city's north side now, up Michigan Avenue. Also a likely factor in the fire spread was the amount of flammable waste that had accumulated in the river from years of improper disposal methods used by local industries. I still think they're clearing that out, by the way.
I'm not swimming in that river.
Yeah,
yeah, it's further down. Yeah. It looks nice on the surface.
You're kayaking, you're fine, but I wouldn't go much deeper.
Yeah, exactly. No.
So, despite the fact that the fire is spreading, it's growing rapidly, the city's firefighters, weary from days and days of fighting fires, are trying their best to battle this blaze. A short time after the fire jumped the river, a burning piece of timber lodged on the roof of the city's waterworks.
Uh-oh.
Within minutes, the interior of the building was engulfed in flames, and the building was destroyed. And with it, the city's main mains and the water mains, they went dry.
Uh-oh.
And at that point...
Well, there you go. That's...
The city's helpless at that point.
Yeah.
The fire burned unchecked, building to building, block to block. All day on October 9th, this fire rages. But late in the evening on October 9th, it started to rain. but the fire had already started to burn itself out. It had spread to sparsely populated areas of the north side, having consumed the densely populated areas thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
So, once the fire had ended, the smoldering remains were still too hot to survey the damage. For many days, eventually the city determined the fire destroyed about 4 miles long and about 3/4 mile wide. So kind of a narrow, long pathway encompassing an area more than 2,000 acres. Destroyed were more than 73 miles of roads, 120 miles of sidewalk, 2,000 lampposts, 17,500 buildings, and $222 million in property, which is about a third of the city's entire valuation in 1871.
Yeah.
90,000 Chicago residents, 1 in 3 Chicagoans left homeless, 120 bodies recovered, but the death toll likely was near 300. The coroner speculated that an accurate count was impossible. Some victims may have drowned or been incinerated, of course, leaving no remains. So that's the fire. And now we got to figure out who did it. So the legend of Mrs. O'Leary's cow kind of gets popularly told by a writer who later admits that he made it up for a good copy. And as we kind of mentioned, that most witnesses seem to describe the O'Leary's emerging from their house sleeping. Doesn't mean that the cow didn't do it itself, though. Maybe the O'Leary's left a lantern on. Pegleg claims that the barn and all the buildings were dark, but maybe one small lantern in the hay, perhaps the cow did kick it over. I don't think the popular theory is that Mrs. O'Leary was milking the cow.
Right.
The cow kicked it over. That doesn't seem likely, but the cow is still a suspect, one of those 5 cows that was in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned Daniel Pegleg, and here's how he becomes a suspect. Pegleg Sullivan, who in his retelling of the story,
right,
finds the fire first, yells out, in fact, gets trapped in it and is rescued by the rope of a calf running out. Which, if it sounds a little too good to be true, maybe it is. A century after the fire, officials turned their attention to this suspect. Time magazine reporting in 1971 that Mrs. O'Leary's one-legged neighbor, who was allegedly, according to other people, having a nightcap in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was laying down by the fence, a couple away, about to retire for the evening. Others say no, he was having a nightcap in that barn. He admitted he knew the barn. He admitted to people that he had been in that barn time before. So maybe he was trying to stay off the public way, having a nightcap, when a spark from his pipe ignited the hay. As he tried to flee, his peg leg stuck in the floor.
To blame people, you're not going to blame somebody who's going to be able to be traced uphill. Now, if you blame Mrs. O'Leary's cow, the cow can't be sued.
Yeah.
It can be the O'Leary.
Can't litigate against a cow. Boy, I've tried.
You can't litigate against a cow. So Dick Bales is the author, and boy, if I had the book at my hand, I would be able to page through in books.
I'll look it up. Hey, Paul.
Hundreds of pages of books.
Paul's going with Lewis Cohn. Thank you for the phone call, Paul. All right, we got a Cohn. We got a Pegleg Sullivan. Michael Heidemann, who are you doing? Who done it?
This is very interesting because I didn't realize how many different angles you could take with this story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that... because Roger brought up a lot of good points, and then Paul just came out with me with a solid curveball.
Right. My whole jury is tainted, by the way. You all have, other research y'all have done. Just supposed to listen to the evidence in front of you and make a decision.
The beautiful thing is that back in the day when they really needed to pin this down, that's why they probably all blamed the cow, because they're like, I don't need a record. I have nothing. We don't have Google yet.
They're like, whatever. Who cares? Let's move on with our lives.
What I'm thinking, though, is after hearing your story, which was great, and it was cool how it was laid out in all those fashions. I don't think it was the comet.
Okay, no comet, all right.
A little bit too out there, and I think that comets do get a little bit colder when they hit Earth. We could ask.
Oh, yeah, we could ask, what's up with space coming up at midnight?
But, Pegleg Sue, he was...
Pegleg Sullivan.
Oh.
Okay.
We go way back. I know it was something different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was a good way to look at it because, he...
I'm so glad they don't do trials like this where they ask each jury member to decide individually
and
tell us how...
Well, we're polling the jury.
How they got to this. They just say a name. Jeez, what the heck is happening? Thank God. Trials last long enough already without asking the jury to give a darn 2 paragraphs on what they think.
Yeah, I like the lunch in the jury room.
Leave it for the deliberation room. Let's go. Come on. Beep, beep.
Okay, my God. So after gathering the evidence, I think that what I would have to go with is, like most fires, it's usually set by a group of rowdy kids, and for that reason, I'm going with Mr. Lewis Cone.
Mr. Lewis Cone. That's two for Cone, one for Peg Leg. And I am going to sway us all the way over. I know you need a unanimous jury here in the United States, but I think Lewis Cone did it. He admitted to it. Gambling makes sense. And then also Peg Leg, it kind of can match up with some of the stories. Mm-hmm. Peg Leg Sullivan isn't necessarily lying when that fire breaks out. He sees it and runs into the barn. I don't know if, you know, some of the details have changed over the years. I think he embellished it a little bit that he got stuck in the cow dragged him out, that sort of stuff. I don't necessarily believe, but that makes sense because they said the gambling, once the fire started, they had drawn attention to the game. They didn't think it was going to spread that far. He grabs the money, they all spread quickly, and then in comes and Peg Leg here, and I don't think it's a comet. I think that's a great theory, and I really believed that for a while until I read more of the science behind it, and I'd say let's stop blaming the cows. One more theory on 312-917-200 from the texter. Jerry says he suspects it was Brian Noonan, and guess what? It was Sunday night just after 9 o'clock, so Noonan wrapping up his show might have gone just a few miles away for a little craps game. I know Noonan likes underground craps games, and I'm sure that happened. And Fijian Radio was almost around at the time. That was fun.
Just about, yeah.
So the case is closed. Ding dong. Do we have a gavel noise? Do we have anything? There it is. We have ruled Lewis Cone set the fire. We'll change subjects after this, thank God, on 720 WGN.